obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Hi, everybody. My name is Pat, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Pat.
And I'm happy to be here, happy to be sober. You know, I get to do this once in a while, and it's always nice to be. Thank you, Billy, for inviting me. It's always nice to be invited, but it's not always fun. We've had the most fun this weekend, really. I haven't laughed this much in a long time. It's great to hang out with old friends and some new ones, and it's just great. I'm really happy to be here. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous if you're new. This is the best thing that's ever happened to me. I certainly didn't think that when I got here. You know, I thought it was about the worst thing that it might, you know, I had sunk this low, Alcoholics Anonymous. But my life has changed so much and in ways that I could not even have imagined when I got here. I started drinking when I was 13 because I was at a party and people were drinking. And I just wanted to fit in. And so I put my hand out and I took that rum and coke and tried to act like I'd been drinking forever, you know. And the magic happened for me that night, and that is it changed how I felt. You know, I've always described myself as being shy. I can't talk to you. It's hard for me to have a conversation when you're talking. I can't hear you because I'm thinking about what I'm going to say when you pause. And, you know, and so I'm at this party, and I'm feeling all of that, and it went away. It just went away. I could talk to people. I said funny things, made people laugh. I danced and felt like the best dancer there. It was magic. Now, I drank too much that night, which was to become my habit. I blacked out. I passed out. I woke up in bed the next morning with a Marine that I didn't know. Now, that's a lot more than I meant to do that night, you know. A nice girl from Newport Beach, the girls in my crowd were not behaving this way, and I felt bad the next day. I felt embarrassed and ashamed. I was terrified I'd get pregnant, you know. All the bad feelings that you can imagine a young girl would have under those circumstances, I had those bad feelings. Yet, I drank again at the very next opportunity without a second thought. I was evidently willing to pay the price to drink from the gate. You know, I certainly didn't think that through at the time. But, you know, when I drank, it never got any better. It got a lot worse. But when I drink, I get friendly. So I developed this reputation in high school for being a friendly girl. And, you know, that's not really how I wanted people to think of me. I wanted people to admire and respect me. I meant to grow up and get married and stay married to the same person forever. You know, I meant to live like this decent, good life. I was a straight A, up until the time I drank, I was a straight A student. I went to church on Sunday. I was very involved in a church youth group. And I did those things because they were important to me. That's how I wanted to be living my life. And it seems like, you know, the next day after I got drunk that first time, of course it wasn't quite that fast, but within a relatively short period of time, I was getting C's and D's in school. I'd quit going to church, dropped out of that youth group, had a whole new set of friends, had an ID that said I was 35 or something, and there was actually a liquor store in Newport Beach, shame on them, that would sell out the back door to minors on such an ID, and my life had changed. And my parents noticed, and they sent me away to boarding school for my last couple of years of high school, an all-girls school, which did what they wanted it to do, which is it was a very structured environment. There were no boys, number one, and it was very difficult to get alcohol there. So I kind of buckled down and studied and brought my grades up and graduated successfully. And I got married. I started going to a local college, and I got married at the end of that first year of college. You know, I was sober a while, and I thought I should go back to college and finish my education, so I sent for my transcripts. Now, I know I went there for a year, but when I got my transcripts, there were 6 units on it. I don't know quite what happened there, you know. I apparently didn't go regularly, I'm guessing. I don't know. But anyway, I'm going to college, and I got married in June of that year because this boy asked. He wasn't really even the one I liked the best, but he asked. And I remember thinking the night that he asked me to marry him, oh, I'm not going to have to worry about that anymore. Now, I was, I think, 17 years old when he asked me, which is not over the hill by anybody's standards. And yet I had, you know, in retrospect, I can see I had no self-worth whatsoever. And the fact that this boy wanted to marry me was just, oh, okay, yes, absolutely. So We planned this huge church wedding, as the day was drawing closer, I remember thinking, you know, I don't feel the way I think brides-to-be are supposed to be feeling. I read a lot of books, and in books, brides feel stuff that I did not appear to be feeling. But I, of course, never discussed this with anybody. And I remember walking down the aisle on my dad's arm thinking, this is probably a mistake. And I know you're not supposed to be thinking that at that very moment. It was a mistake. We were married for 6 months and got divorced. It's my personal opinion that we don't have to count marriages that are 6 months and under. That's just my opinion, but I bet there's people in this room that would agree with me on that. yes, a couple of hands go up. After I got divorced, I moved up to L.A. I got a job in an apartment, and I was working as a secretary in this trucking company. My parents were divorced. My father was vice president of this trucking company, which is how I got the job. You know, I had these really good secretarial skills, but I'd never actually worked. And so it's hard to get that first job when you're young. So I called him, and I asked him if he would hire me. And I remember he said, oh, honey, I don't know. I'm kind of reluctant to hire a family member. He should have listened to his instincts. He hired me, and I behaved there exactly the way I'd behaved in high school, which is to say, before I left that company, I knew most of those truck drivers. Caused my father a lot of embarrassment. One day he called me, and the agreement was that I could work there for a year, which was good. Then I'd have something solid to put on a resume. And I think I was there maybe 8 or 9 months, and he called me one day, and he tried to talk to me about my behavior. You know, I don't know about you, but I can't even look at my behavior very closely myself. I most certainly cannot discuss it with my father. And so I said some really ugly things to him on the phone that day just to get him off the phone. And the end result of that conversation is we did not talk again for many years, except when absolutely necessary at weddings and funerals, until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and made amends to him. And he's 94. He doesn't know anybody anymore. But until he got in that condition, we had a good, loving relationship, 100% because of you, because you taught me how to do that. Anyway, I left that job before the year was up because I couldn't face, you know, when you drink the way I do and you drink with the people that you're working with, it's awkward. And so I left. And I could keep a job. I'm a very good secretary, so I never have any trouble getting a job. But I drink, and so at some point I embarrass and humiliate myself. And I was good for just about a year on a job before it just got so awkward that I would have to leave. I've left jobs after office Christmas parties without going back to clean out my desk because I knew I couldn't face them in the light of day. You know, I did drink a lot in blackouts, and actually I'm kind of grateful for it. I remember plenty. I don't need more information, truly. Here's how I drank. I went out with my boss and my coworkers one night. We're bar hopping around downtown L.A., and we're all drinking. I'm not the only one drunk that night, but possibly drunker than the rest of them, because when we wound up in the strip joint, I was the only one who auditioned for a job. I know you'll understand when I explain this to you. Not my fault, really. We're at this stage was like here. We were at this table right in front of the stage, and I had excused myself from the table to go to the ladies' room, which was down the hall behind the stage. Bumped into the owner of the bar in the hallway there, and was making some derogatory remarks about the caliber of his entertainment. And he said something along the lines of, if I thought I was such hot stuff, which apparently I thought. So a moment ago, I was sitting at this table with my boss and my coworkers, dressed more or less as I am dressed tonight, there this morning, and now moments later, I'm on the stage essentially dressed in nothing. And there was that moment when my boss's eye and mine met, when he saw who that was up there. I'll never forget the look on his face, ever. It's embedded in there. When I sobered up the next day, that's another job I left, like, immediately, but when I sobered up the next day, I thought, you know, kind of gave me ideas. You know, on the one hand, I was appalled. I mean, a strip joint is really about as low as you could go, in my opinion, at the time. I actually went lower, but at the time, it seemed about as low as you could go. But I thought, this is when go-go dancing was sort of becoming very popular, and in my mind's eye, go-go dancing seemed classier than stripping. It's not, but I convinced myself that it was, and so I actually got a paid job as a go-go dancer. Now, all the nice clubs on the Sunset Strip in Los Angeles had go-go dancers. I did not work there. My first paid job as a dancer was in a club on Whittier Boulevard in East Los Angeles. I never met anybody in that bar who spoke English. I have no idea how I got that job. Then I moved uptown to a place, uptown in my mind, because they spoke English in the next place. It was actually on the outskirts of Chinatown and downtown LA, which is another way of saying it was on the outskirts of Skid Row, because they come kind of close together there. So I'm working at Nick's there as a dancer, and I met the man who was to become my second husband. He was a customer and clearly recognized talent. And the kind of clubs I worked in, dancing ability was not necessarily a requirement. Anyway, he was probably the most unsuitable man in the state of California for me. So, of course, we moved right in together and eventually did get married. And so now I'm married again, but I am by now a full-blown alcoholic. I mean, there's no doubt about it. When we started having a lot of trouble in this marriage, although I'm married, I'm still behaving as though I'm single. And I don't mean to be this kind of a person. I want to be a faithful wife, but I apparently am incapable of doing so. He drank. I met him in a bar, after all. But it turns out he didn't drink as much as I did. And it wasn't so much my drinking that he objected to. It was, you know, my behavior behind drinking. And so we had a lot of trouble in this marriage. He was a gambler, and he was gone a lot at night, which was fine with me. You know, it was a terrible marriage. It was just awful. I started getting arrested, and I can't believe this is happening to me. I'm a nice girl from Newport Beach, but it was happening to me. My first arrest was on a Thanksgiving night. I'd been to Thanksgiving dinner at my parents' house in Newport. We were living in L.A., and my husband wasn't... Did I mention my family was unhappy about this marriage? My husband wasn't invited. Actually, they never met him. They felt so strongly about it. So I've gone to Newport to my parents' house for Thanksgiving dinner. My husband has gone to... He was a chef, and he worked at this restaurant in Beverly Hills, and the restaurant had a party or something there, so he went to that. So or it was actually at his boss's house. So I'm at my parents' house. My parents were big drinkers, so I drank a lot there. I'm driving home, and I remember I needed cigarettes, so I stopped in a bar, of course, to get cigarettes. Where else would you stop to buy cigarettes? And drank some there. And the bar, by the way, was on Main Street in downtown LA, which absolutely is Skid Row and is not in a direct line from my parents' home in Newport to where I was living. But nonetheless, that's where I was. And I came out of that bar and got arrested for common drunk on Main Street in downtown LA. They took me to Civil Brand, which is the Women's Institute, or was then. And boy, now there's a scary place. I was in way over my head, way over my head. Scary women in there. They told me I could make a phone call, and I remembered where my husband was at his boss's house, so I called there, and his boss's wife answered the phone, and I identified myself and told her that I was in jail. Could she have my husband come bail me out? It did not occur to me it would have been nicer to speak directly to him to deliver that news. And yet, you know, years later, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I sat in meetings for a long time hearing you talk about making amends and seriously sitting in my chair thinking, no, I can't really think of anybody I hurt. If I knew you 3 minutes, I probably hurt you. I'm, as the big book describes, completely selfish and self-centered. It took me a long time into sobriety to see that, but that is who I am. My next arrest was in Tijuana for obscene dancing. I need to stop telling this story. I said that for years from the podium, and my husband finally said to me one time, you know, you should make it clear that there were no animals involved. And I thought, oh my God, it never occurred to me people were thinking that. There were no animals involved. So you kind of get the picture. Things were not going well. My husband, as I mentioned, was a gambler, so he was gone a lot at night. After the arrest, I started drinking at home a lot because it was just scary out there. You know, the people that I was ending up with were scarier, and the situations that I found myself in were, I don't know if they were scarier. You know, this just popped in my head. When I was, I must have been 18, 17 maybe, I was working at JCPenney Company. This is early in my drinking, fairly early in my drinking. I'm working at JCPenney, and the credit and layaway department. And the phone rang there, and the store closed at 10 o'clock or something. I was working in the evening, and the phone rang there one night. And this man said, "May I speak to Pat?" I said, "This is Pat." And he said, "Oh, this is Fred," or whatever. "I met you at such and such a bar last night." Well, I wasn't even old enough to drink in a bar, and I knew I hadn't met him. There was another Pat who worked there who was older. I said, "Oh, you must mean the other Pat. She's off tonight." And he said, "Well, you seem really nice." And I acknowledged that I was. And he said, "You want to meet after work for a drink?" I said, "Sure." So 10 o'clock comes, I get off work, and I go out in the back parking lot where there's now just my car and this strange man's car who I know absolutely nothing about. I get in his car. He can tell by one look at me that I'm not old enough to take to a bar. So he goes to a liquor store. He buys a bottle of whatever. We drive somewhere, and we're parked in an orange grove, drinking and getting to know each other. And he had a hand on each of my shoulders, and he kind of leaned back a little bit, and he looked at me, and he said, "You know, I could kill you right now, and nobody would ever know it, because nobody knows we ever met." Even when I say that all these years later, the hair stands up on the back of my neck, and you can be guaranteed it stood up on the back of my neck that night. I thought, I'm going to die here tonight. But I just didn't know what to do, and I just reached for that bottle and took another drink. Obviously, he didn't kill me. Just a guy with a funny sense of humor, I guess. I don't know. But, you know, that happened early in my drinking. I have been putting myself in situations my whole drinking life that, I'm lucky to be alive, really lucky to be alive. Anyway, I got sidetracked there. That just popped in my head. I don't know why. So my husband is now gone all the time at the racetrack and poker games and stuff, and I'm drinking for the most part in a rocking chair in my living room and listening to the sad records over and over. I like Ray Charles' Born to Lose. Oh, that's, you know, you play it and you cry and feel sorry for yourself and play it again and cry some more. My downstairs neighbors asked me one time if I could just play something else once in a while. They were really getting kind of sick of it. And then sometimes I'd call people on the phone. I've heard AA speakers say, you know, they did things like called the White House and demanded to speak to the president. I didn't do that. I called people I knew, like a boyfriend I had when I was 12. Of course, I have no idea where he's living today, so, because I'm now in my, whatever, late 20s or something. And so I wait, and if you're a phone caller or if you're an Al-Anon, you know this never happens at 7:30 in the evening. You know, it's always 2 or 3 in the morning. And so I wake up several people trying to find him, and I found him. And I'm pretty sure he and his wife were happy to hear from me, although he never did call back. Anyway, you know, my life was a mess. I hated my husband, which was fine. He hated me, too. I wasn't getting along with my parents. I hated my job. I peaked in my career when I was about 23. When I was 23 years old, I was working as a legal secretary, making a lot of money for somebody that age, and a really good future. And my last job, I got sober when I was 30, and my last job was as a clerk in a YMCA. My job was, if you were a member of that Y and you came in to pay your dues, I'm the person who wrote you the receipt, and I was barely hanging on to that job by the skin of my teeth. I convinced my mother would say, "Why are you working in such a low job?" And I would say to her, and believe this, "You know, Mom, if you work at a Y, you can take their classes for free, tap dancing or yoga." Now, of course, I never set foot in a class, but I could have, you know. And so I thought that was a pretty nice fringe benefit, and convinced my mother that's why I was working there. Oh, my mother, the grief and the anguish and the worry that we put our mothers through. If I got nothing else out of sobriety but the fact that I quit tormenting my mother, that I was sober and quit tormenting my mother, really, I would have been overpaid. You know, it was terrible what I did to her. Anyhow, so I'm in this terrible marriage, and I remember one hot summer day looking out the window. We lived in a second floor apartment. From my chair, I could see the neighbor's backyard, and they were a young couple about my age, which was probably late 20s at the time, and they had two small children, and the kids were running back and forth in the sprinklers on the lawn, and the parents were sitting on the porch steps watching their kids play, laughing and talking, and I cried watching them, because that's how I meant to be living my life. I don't know how I got into this terrible condition up here in my apartment, but I knew that day, watching those neighbors, that it was never going to change for me. I had been trying for a long time by then not to drink. I knew that nothing good was ever going to happen in my life if I continued to drink the way I was drinking. So, okay, this isn't rocket science. I'll quit drinking. But I couldn't do it. You know, I'd wake up in the morning filled with firm resolve. I'm not going to drink today. I'm not going to do it. And I'd go off to that little job, and I'm going to take some of these classes at this Y. I'll get physically fit. It's going to be a whole new me. I'll go back to college and finish my education. It's going to be great. But I'm an alcoholic, and before the day's over, I'm calling bottle and keg liquor to deliver a new bottle because I need it, you know. I dealt with a liquor store that delivered, not because I have any big issues about drinking and driving. I did it all the time. But I got a little weird towards the end. I got a little paranoid. The drapes were always drawn. I remember a lot of time peeking out behind there at trying to figure out what they were doing. Not sure who they were, and I'm not sure what I thought they might be doing, but they were making me really nervous. I'd come home from work and I'd drink whatever was left in the bottle from the night before if there was, and I'd call the liquor store to deliver a new one. And, you know, towards the end, when I would come home from work, and this is one of those things I did without really thinking about it, because you can't look at these things too closely. I would come home from work, I'd put my purse down, I'd write the check for the liquor store. It's always the same amount, a fifth of scotch, two packs of cigarettes, and a tip for the delivery guy. I mean, it's virtually the same amount always. Now, I would just write that check out, and I'd put it by the door. And I would go in the kitchen, I'd pour myself a drink. I'm okay now. And, of course, the reason I did that is sometimes by the time I call the liquor store and by the time they actually get there, I'm too drunk to write the check. Sometimes I'm already passed out by the time they get there. I was such a good customer of that liquor store that they actually would leave the bag on my porch because they knew I would come down the next day and give them the check. And I always did. My utilities were often turned off. I paid late payments on everything, but I never bounced a check at Bottle and Keg Liquor. You got to have your priorities straight. One night I called Alcoholics Anonymous. I was drunk. My husband was off wherever he was, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and a really nice man answered the phone and asked me if I was having a problem with alcohol. I said that I was, and I started to cry. And he stayed on the phone with me a long time, told me a lot about himself, way more than I was interested in. But he was talking to me, and my mother now was the only one still taking those calls. And he wanted to send some women to my house. I said, no, thank you. I don't think I'm that bad. And he seemed to understand. And he said, do you think you could not drink tomorrow and go to a meeting tomorrow night? And I said, yes. Actually, I doubt very much that I can not drink tomorrow. I drink every day. But obviously, yes was the right answer. So I said, yes. We talked a while. He gave me the address, and we talked a while longer, and we hung up. And of course, I continued to drink until I passed out. When I woke up the next morning, I remembered making the call, and I remembered bits and pieces of it, and I found the piece of paper with the address of the meeting hall. Now, in the light of day, I thought I'd been a little premature in calling AA. I was pretty sure 30 was too young to be an alcoholic, but I couldn't get it out of my mind all day. I just kept thinking about it, and I said to my husband at the dinner table that night, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. He was like, yeah, whatever. We were not getting along at all. He went off to the track, and I dressed carefully to go to my first AA meeting. Now, women understand this. I've always, drunk or sober, I always kind of want to be dressed appropriately for wherever I'm going, but I've never been to AA, so I have no idea how that might be. I don't know what I was thinking exactly. What I remember when I left the house is there was a pile of clothes on the bed that I had tried and discarded as evidently not being quite right. I'm guessing that in the end I decided to go for comfort, because what I arrived to Alcoholics Anonymous in were baggy jeans, rubber thongs on my feet, and a knit top that had no knit left in it. It was really comfy. I had a red one and a blue one, and that's what I wore to meetings. I was clean. I alternated, washed one and wore the other. And that's what I wore to meetings for my first, I don't think, 2 or 3 months, and nobody ever said a word about how I was dressed until one night, as I say, I was a couple of months sober, and I was kind of running late that day, and I didn't have time from work to go home and change into my meeting clothes, so I went to the meeting dressed in what I'd worn to work that day, which was a nice pantsuit in a very soft rose color. And I think that night, 300 people individually said to me, my, you look pretty tonight, and it made me feel pretty, and it made me start thinking about how I was dressing for meetings. But to go back to that first meeting, so I'm in these terrible clothes. The meeting starts at 8:30, so of course I got there at 8:28. The guy on the phone said, don't drink, so I didn't drink. At 8:28, sometimes I'm already passed out. I needed a drink real bad that night at 8:28. I go up to the door of this meeting hall, and I'm in these clothes, and I'm drenched in sweat, and shaking, and there was a man at the door who put out his hand and said, "Hello, my name is Clint. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." It made me feel welcome. You know, I think it's the single most important thing anybody ever does in a meeting. Way more important than the speaker. Way more important than anything, really. I went in the room. Now it's 8:29, and there were about 300 people at that meeting, and so I'm standing there, you know, like a deer in headlights, and a man came up and asked me if I was new, and I couldn't imagine how he knew that. And I said, yes, I was, and he got me a big book and a seat in the back of the room, and the meeting started. And it was a speaker meeting. And the speaker that night was a man by the name of Norm A. And I love saying his name because you can pick out the old-timers in the room right away. They all smile when you say his name. I heard him. We actually drank in one of the same places, although many years apart. He was much older than I. But, you know, I got hope that night. I believe that he drank the way I drank. I believe that I could see that he was sober. Even sitting way in the back of the room, I could feel his energy and his joy in living. Now, I think maybe that night I believed if I did whatever it is you're doing here, which I had no idea what that was yet, that maybe I could stay sober, but I knew I could never feel the way that guy felt. You can't get from where I am to there. It's impossible. But I got just enough hope to keep coming back. I didn't drink for 6 days. Saturday to Friday, I didn't drink. And every day I remember thinking, wow, AA really works. This is great. I had done nothing except go to that meeting. Friday night I was drunk, and I thought, oh, well, I can't be drunk. I'm in AA, but I was drunk. And went back to the meeting, and on Saturday raised my hand for being under a week of sobriety again, and I got some more phone numbers. I'd gotten phone numbers the first week, but one of these ladies said, you might want to call one of us, which of course I hadn't done. I don't know you. I don't even know what I would say to you. She said, you know, you might want to call one of us. So I drank a couple more times that week, and I called her. I was drunk when I called her, and she said, you might want to get a sponsor. You don't seem to be doing too well on your own, and most of us have found sponsors to be pretty helpful. I had no idea what a sponsor was. Had I known, you might have a different speaker here today, honestly. I come from a group that believes in strong sponsorship. I had no idea what was about to come. But I said, okay, what do I do? And she said, meet me tomorrow night. Should you have a big book? I said, yes. She said, bring it with you and meet me tomorrow night early before the meeting and we'll talk about it. Tomorrow was a Thursday. That's not meeting night. Saturday is meeting night. But I kind of sensed I shouldn't point that out to her. And so I met her the next night, Thursday, and the first thing she did is she took my copy of the big book and opened it to the front cover and told me to write that day's date in there. I wrote that date in there. She said, that's your sobriety date. I remember thinking, I shouldn't have done that in ink. I don't think that's going to be my sobriety date. Very happy to report that is my sobriety date, August 28th, 1975. The next thing she did is she took a meeting directory and she circled a meeting for every night of the week. She didn't suggest that I go to a lot. She didn't recommend that I go to a meeting every night. She just said, on Monday you'll go here, Tuesday there, Wednesday over here, Thursday. I said, excuse me, no. I'm a married woman. My husband is really not happy that I'm at this meeting tonight. There is no way I can go to one every night. It's completely out of the question. I can't do it. And she said, she was so sweet that night. That night being the key word. She said something like, well, maybe you can do it with less, but not with me as your sponsor. She said something like, if you want what I have, I only know one way to get it, and that's to do what I do, and this is what I do. My life hung in the balance. Here's the real miracle for me, I think, happened right in that conversation, because I found myself agreeing to what she was asking me to do. If you're new, this is really important. I didn't agree happily, and I definitely did not do it happily, but I did it, and that is why I'm standing here today 38 years later. You know, thank you. I started going to meet. Now, I was right. My husband did not like this at all. Now, here's the thing. I'd been cheating on him all the years we've been married. Now I'm off every night, and he, of course, thinks I'm coming to Alcoholics Anonymous to meet men. Now, it's true I had noticed there were men in AA, and I was not at all opposed to the idea of getting, shall we say, better acquainted with some of you. But none of the men in AA seemed to be interested in me. And it really made me mad my husband was accusing me of something that I was not actually doing right at that minute. So I felt really, really, really sorry for myself. I cried all the time, all the time. I would come home from work. I would have dinner with my husband. We'd have this huge fight about me going to the meeting. My sponsor told me I had to get to every meeting an hour early, not like 55 minutes early, but 1 hour early. And I was to get there early, have commitments that you like cookies or chairs or coffee, things you do before the meeting, do my commitment, and then circulate throughout the room after I've finished my commitment, shaking hands with other people as they arrive, asking them how they are as though I care. So I have dinner with my husband. We have the huge fight about me going to AA. I get in the car. You know, I'm driving to the meeting. I'm sobbing. It's a miracle I wasn't killed in a car accident driving to a meeting because I sobbed the whole way to the meeting. And I would think, it's not worth it. If this is sobriety, you can have it. I'll go to your stupid meeting tonight because I'm already out of the house tonight. But this is the last one I'm going to. I can't do it. It's too hard. It's causing me too much trouble. And I'd get to the meeting and I'd slam the cookies around in the kitchen or whatever my job was. And then I'd go work the room. You know, hi, Hilda, how are you? And, of course, she would say something like, fine, Pat, how are you? And I'd tell her how I was. Till her eyes would glaze over, and then I'd move on to the next person, you know. And, oh, my God, it was painful for me, and I'm certain for everybody I talked to. Eventually, the meeting would start, and I'd get some relief. I went to a lot of speaker meetings in the beginning, and I'm grateful for it because I didn't get much out of discussion meetings when I was new. In a discussion meeting when I was new, here's what happens. We're like in a circle, and these people are sharing. It's coming towards me. I hear nothing that they're saying because, of course, I'm thinking what I'm going to say when it's my turn. Now it's my turn. I say something. Now these people are sharing. And now I'm thinking, God, that was stupid. Why did I say that? So I don't hear these people either. In a speaker meeting like this, I knew that for 45 minutes or an hour or whatever it was, nothing was going to be expected of me. And I actually could hear sometimes things that the speaker was saying. I learned the most important thing I've learned in 38 years when I was about 3 months sober. I was working the room, as I just described to you, and I went up to this guy, Larry, in my home group, and he asked me how I was, and I started to tell him, and he cut me off. He said, I don't want to listen to that. Why don't you go find a newcomer to talk to? Perhaps you'd feel better. And he pointed to a girl in the back of the room. He said, that girl in the red dress is at her very first meeting. Why don't you just march over and say hello? I remember clearly thinking that I did not care if the girl in the red dress lived or died. I wish Larry would die. But I knew that if I didn't do it, he would tell my sponsor. So this shouldn't take but a moment. So I go over to say hello to this girl. If my memory is correct, I'm ashamed to say that I believe I was crying as I welcomed her to Alcoholics Anonymous. Put out my hand, as, you know, hello, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. The girl who had 12-stepped her, who I knew from the meeting, said, oh, Pat, I'm so happy to see you. This is this girl's first meeting, and I've been waiting for you because she had this big fight with her husband about coming to AA, and I know you're the exact right person to talk to her. You know how things run through your mind really fast and because kind of simultaneous things? My first thought was, no, I'm the worst person in this entire room to talk to. I have nothing of value to share. I missed that I was sober. That was kind of valuable. All I could see was how sad my life was. But at the same time I'm thinking, there's a girl standing in front of me at her first meeting. I should try to be positive here. And I opened up my mouth and I heard myself say, keep coming back. It gets better a day at a time. Now I've just lied to a newcomer. But I had a spiritual experience that night, an honest-to-God spiritual experience that night. There was a center aisle in the room. I know I didn't talk to this girl more than 5 minutes. Not that yet, that long even. I was incapable of having a conversation. I turned and I was walking back down the center aisle, and I had this moment. I just stopped dead in my tracks. It's like God hit me on the head. And I realized it was the first time in that hour period of time, from the time I hit the door of the meeting hall until the meeting actually starts, that I was at the meeting and I wasn't crying. And the reason I wasn't crying is for this brief little moment, I tried to say something positive to this girl who was newer than me, and I felt better. It turns out when I'm thinking about you, I can't be thinking about me at the same time. And any time I'm not thinking about me, I'm having a better day. And so is everybody around me. You know, I would like to tell you from that moment to this, I've happily worked with others and lived it, but that would be a lie. But it's a lesson I've never forgotten, and it always, always, always works.
To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Let's see, where am I going to go here? It seemed to me, you know, I'm sober a number of months, and it seems to me that I'm having all these troubles with my marriage, and it seems to me that the troubles in this marriage must be his fault because I'm working this spiritual program now. It can't be my fault. Well, I wasn't exactly working a spiritual program at home. I'd done nothing to try to be a kind and loving wife or change anything about it. With an attitude like that, of course, it was inevitable that I would meet a man in a meeting who looked good to me. Actually, I'd met many, but one who looked back. I was about 10 months sober. The gentleman in question was about 10 minutes sober. I saw him when he came in the door the first night. He had a Fu Manchu mustache and a shaved head. Oh, my God, my heart started to pound. I leapt across the chair to introduce myself to him, and my sponsor noticed. And I went over to my sponsor, and she said, "Let's not forget, Pat, that you're a married woman." And I said, "Yeah, but I am so unhappy." She said, "Nonetheless, you're married, and as long as you're married, I expect you to act married." And I said, "I don't see this as a problem." God, I get all hot talking about this. I don't see this as a problem. I'll get divorced. And she said, "No, we in Alcoholics Anonymous don't think it's a good idea to make major moves in our first year of sobriety. You stay married and act married." Well, I was obsessed with this man. I know you understand obsession if you're in this room. Why would God get this guy sober in my home group if he did not mean for us to be together? So we start. I now refer to this as the death dance. It starts with deep, meaningful glances across the AA hall. And then we're kind of brushing up against each other in the coffee line. And then he's walking me to my car after the meeting. And then I'm parking further and further away from the meeting. It's a little tricky getting together. I'm a married woman. Obviously, we're not going to go to my place. He's a newcomer. He doesn't have a place. But we're pretty resourceful people. I was working at the time at a record company in Hollywood, and he was very conveniently working in Hollywood at a porn bookstore. So I arranged this long lunch artwork for my friend at work to cover for me. He didn't have a car either, so I picked him up at the bookstore. And we went to a motel, and we got to know each other. And I drove him back to the bookstore that afternoon and dropped him off. And I was driving back to my office, and it occurred to me in the car that I was 10 months sober. And I was living exactly the way I'd always lived. I'd been hearing you say pretty much every night for 10 months that I was going to have to change everything about the way I'd been living my life or I was probably going to drink. I'm not sure what I was thinking during those 10 months. I suspect it was something along the lines of this somehow doesn't apply to me. But I knew that day in the car it did, and I was scared. Here's the thing. I've never wanted to live that way, drunk or sober. I never wanted to live that way. And now I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's like there's no excuse. You know what I'm saying? And I was also terrified to tell my sponsor what I'd done because she'd been very, very clear in her direction about this guy. But the bottom line is I don't want to drink. And so this is how we are. So I get to the meeting that night. My sponsor is barely out of her car. I'm knocking her down. "I have to talk to you right now." And she's like, "Can I just shut my car door first before we..." So I told her what I'd done, and she said, "Pat, I don't think that you're a woman who can cheat on her husband and stay sober, and you don't have to live that way anymore if you don't want to." Okay, as I've just said, I don't want to, never wanted to, don't get how you're going to help me. I don't get this. I don't get Alcoholics Anonymous at all. Here's what I did. If you're new and this interests you, you got to pay really close attention because it goes by really fast. A day at a time, I stayed away from that guy. That's it. That's it. You wanted something deeper, and didn't I? Did you know? Day at a time, I didn't call him on the phone. A day at a time, I didn't take his calls. A day at a time, I didn't drive by that bookstore. A day at a time, when I saw him at meetings, I shook hands with a locked elbow. If you're new, this means we never got closer than the entire length of my arm. I thought I should explain to him what was happening. Unfortunately, ran that idea by my sponsor, and she said, "Oh, I think you'll get the idea." No closing conversations here. I heard her, and I also heard, I think for the very first time, really heard that line that is read in every single meeting I go to out of the big book, "Half measures avail us nothing." And I knew for me this was the big turning point. This was going to be the make it or break it for me. And so I did it 100% her way. I just stayed away from that guy. Now, the obsession, of course, passed because obsessions always pass. But the really great news, and the part I had no idea would happen, is that I don't live that way anymore. What a miracle. I had no idea. My first sponsor drank when I was a year and a half sober. I got a new sponsor right away, she said to me, she was sober a long time, and she said, I've watched you from as far away as I could get, whine and complain about your husband. I want you a day at a time to act as though you're a kind and loving wife. She said, you owe a lot of amends to this guy, and the big book is really clear on these difficult amends. It says right in black and white there in the step, you can't make direct amends when to do so might injure that person or others. That means, Pat, you cannot go home and confess infidelities that he may not know about. It's not about clearing your conscience. It's about making things right. It's like it's about trying to put them back together the way they were before you screwed it all up. And so I didn't, she said, I don't know what's going to happen to your marriage. Obviously, it's a bad marriage, and you know, maybe you'll have to walk away from it down the road somewhere. But if you stay in the meantime and act as though you're a kind and loving wife, you can make some daily living amends to him. And then if you do have to walk away somewhere in the future, perhaps you can do it with no guilt. The idea of no guilt really caught my attention, and I became willing to do what she was saying. I remember the first thing she told me to do was every day when I went home from work, and before I left for the meeting, I was to ask him how his day had been and look at him and listen while he told me. And my direction was to listen for a minimum of 10 minutes. And this is the God's truth. I went that first day, I kind of checked my watch, and I said, so how was your day? He looked kind of surprised that I was asking. He said something that had happened to him at work. I didn't know any of the people that he worked with, or, you know, none of it had any relevance to me. When the 10 minutes were up, I left the room. You know, we had the same fight that night we always had before I left for the meeting, but that night in the car, I wasn't crying, and I couldn't figure it out for a long time. Nothing's changed. Still had the same fight we've always had, but something had changed. I finally had taken my focus off the problem, and I was busy in the solution. And as soon as I get busy in the solution, I feel better. It doesn't matter what the status of the problem might still be. I started watching couples in AA, how they treat each other. She taught me a lot of stuff, but I don't have time to talk about it all. But I started watching couples in AA, and it's, you know, there's good examples and there's bad examples. And I tried to take the good stuff home and practice it in my home. And it always sounds really fast when I'm up here talking about it. But months went by, and I was on my knees one night thanking God for my sobriety. And I started to get up, and I realized I was comfortable in that house with that husband. And it didn't happen that day, and it didn't happen yesterday. This is the biggest problem in my life, and I missed when it ended. You know, I got back down on my knees, and I thank God for this. I wasn't even sure what the feeling was, but I thank God for it. And I remember I said, if you mean for me to stay married to this man, I believe that I could do that and stay sober and have a happy life. Thank you. Not long after that, we found out that he had cancer. My immediate thought, because this is who I am, is I wish this would have happened when I hated him. You know, it's always about me. I'm very, very, very glad it did not happen when I hated him. But, you know, I just kept doing what I was doing. He was sick for a year and a half, and he did die. And it was a very difficult year and a half, but it was also the best year and a half of our marriage, far and away the best year and a half of our marriage. I was so glad that I had stayed when all of my best judgment had suggested I should just get out. I was glad that I was there and believable. You know what I'm saying? Like, he knew I was there because I wanted to be there, not just because he was sick and dying. Because I had consistently been there in a kind and loving manner for all the time leading up to when he got sick. And I was so grateful that I had stayed. When he died, I went to this little chapel and made some funeral arrangements, and a couple hundred people from Alcoholics Anonymous took the afternoon off to be there. They did not know him, but they came, obviously, for me. And I realized sitting in that chapel that what my sponsor had promised me had happened. I knew, I felt sad, but I knew that I had 100% made my amends to him. I knew it. I felt clean and right about my relationship with him, and I was so, so grateful and remain grateful to this day that I had stayed. I thought that that's like that feeling of knowing 100% that I've made those amends is the payoff for doing the work. It's not even close, not even close to the payoff. God's vision for me is so much greater than anything I can possibly see. I remember when I was new, I'd hear people say, you know, if I'd made a list of everything I wanted when I was new, I would have shortchanged myself. And I would sit out there and think, not me, I got big dreams. Well, yeah, I would have shortchanged myself. After he died, I started dating a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a man who had been my friend before we ever went on a date. That was a new experience for me. Never had I dated a friend, ever. Every relationship I had up to Vince was, we meet, we have sex, and then maybe we embark on a relationship, or not, as the case may be. Vince had been my friend for 3 years, whatever it was, and we started dating, and we fell in love, and we got married. And we had such a great life together. And I know, for me, it would not have been possible had I not learned the tools there with my former husband. You know, you see, again, God's vision is so... I thought I was over this. So much bigger. Vince died a few years ago, and it was hard. It was really hard. I kind of was like a zombie for a couple of years. I mean, I did everything. I went to meetings. I upped my meetings. I continued sponsoring the women I sponsored and did, you know, went to work. I did everything I'm supposed to do, but it's like a fog. I can hardly remember anything of it. Here, this might be the most important thing I have to say ever. As bad as I felt, and honest to God, I didn't know a person could feel that bad for that long, never once did the idea of picking up a drink cross my mind. Never once. And that is because I was then, and remained right in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a meeting in Palm Springs that's called the Cornfield Meeting that I go to sometimes. I love this. And they read the little history about their name before the meeting. And they call it the Cornfield Meeting because they were out riding motorcycles one day in Iowa or somewhere, and they noticed in the cornfields the corn on the outer edges that don't get as much water, they're kind of dying and dead, but the corn in the middle is strong and healthy. And so they named their meeting the Corn, which I love that, you know. And that's what I was. I was in the middle of my meetings, in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous during that time, which is why I'm still sober today, you know. I shortly after Vince died, my mother became ill, and I started having to drive her to Pomona for treatment. And it was like an hour's drive away. And Vince and I were of one political persuasion, and my mother was of the other. Vince loved to talk politics. He loved a really good political, not argument, but, you know, discussion with somebody on the other side who was smart and could argue their point. You know what I'm saying? And my mother was smart and could have, but she was smart enough also to know she never wanted to get in an argument with her son-in-law. So she just kept her mouth shut all those years. We were married 27 years. She never, ever discussed politics with him. And when he would say, because he talked about politics a lot, and when she'd be there, she would just not say anything. So now Vince is gone, and my mother and I are in the car every day for an hour driving to Pomona, and she starts talking politics. And I got it. She thinks she can change my mind now, you know? And I also got that there aren't enough years for me to fully make amends to my mother for the grief and the anguish and the worry that I put her through all those years I was drinking, the sleepless nights, the midnight phone calls, the jail, the accidents, the things that I tormented my mother with. This is like sort of the final push, you know? My whole job here is to make Mom happy, period. So we're driving, she's talking, and I'm saying things like, gosh, Mom, I never thought of it that way before. Or I got this in Al-Anon, not that I go to Al-Anon, but I heard an Al-Anon person say this, you could be right. Oh my God, the veins are sticking out of my neck. I'm like, I can't say this, you know? Get her out to Pomona and get her settled in her treatment room, and I'd say, I'm just going to step out in the courtyard and call my office, see if there's anything I need to be doing. And I'd step out in the courtyard, and I'd burst into tears from just the strain of not saying anything. And then I'd call a friend on the program, and we'd laugh a little bit, and then I'd be able to go back and be okay with my mom. And when she died, you know, I think that she thinks she changed my mind, and that just kind of pleases me, you know. My life is not the way that I wanted it to be now. You know, I retired from my job a couple of years ago, and Vince and I, of course, had plans for retirement and things that we wanted to do, and it, you know, that's not happening. And, you know, I felt sad, obviously, and scared, and but I knew that I wanted to retire, and so I did. But, you know, I didn't go into this blind. I really investigated that, you know, had it narrowed down to a couple of different places that I thought that I knew I had to move because I couldn't afford to live where I was on retirement income. And long story short, I knew before I moved to Palm Desert, three meetings for sure that would be regular meetings of mine before I ever signed the lease on the new place. And those are, in fact, three regular meetings. I have commitments at those meetings. You know, I'm a coffee cleanup person at one, I'm a chair setter-upper on the other, and somebody said to me, God, you're 38 years sober, do you really have to set up chairs? And I said, yeah, I really do. You know, I don't know any better way to get involved in a new AA community than get involved, you know, and that's what I've done, and gotten on a couple of committees, and I don't like committees much, but I know it's a great way to get involved, and so I've done it, you know, and I love when I first moved there, I thought, they're doing it wrong here. AA, they're not doing it right here. But I could hear my sponsor's voice saying, they don't care how you did it at your old home group. And so I've just kind of kept my mouth shut, and I've grown to really love the AA there. Yeah, they do it different, but it's not wrong. It's just different, you know. And I really, really love it there. I have a really full life. I was afraid when I retired that maybe I'd turn into one of those people who just sit around and watch TV all day, and that really scared me, you know. I think the reason I thought that is after Vince died, I spent a lot of time watching, I hate to even say this, watching reruns of America's Next Top Model on TV. I could spend like all day Saturday watching those, and I'd think, this is not, I would think to myself, this can't be good, you know, but it's like I couldn't stop myself. But that has not happened to me in retirement, I'm happy to report. You know, my whole life, before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought, you know, for years I had dreams of doing things, but I never did them. And then pretty soon I didn't even dream about doing anything anymore because I knew I wasn't going to do it. So what's the use of dreaming? You know, even the dreams die. This year I got this big one going, I'm in currently training to go for a little walk next September in Spain on the Camino de Santiago. For those of you who are not familiar, this is a spiritual pilgrimage. It's 500 miles long. I cannot even believe that I am considering doing such an outrageous thing. I'm so excited. And I am participating in my life. You know, I'm living my life. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I hope you stay here. I hope you get a sponsor. I hope you get a home group. Get involved on this committee. Do things. Don't just be a person who shows up and takes a seat and doesn't do anything. You know, be a person who is setting these meetings up or throwing the cookies around in the kitchen or whatever. You know, get yourself a job and be part of AA. Three things I recommend you do if you're new. One is that, get a home group. Get commitments at that home group. Two is get a sponsor. I don't know how anybody would do this without a sponsor. And three is make a friend around your own length of sobriety, somebody you can hang out with and talk to, tell your stuff to. When I was new, I told my friend Betty everything before I told it to my sponsor. When you're new, it's nice to hear how it's going to sound out loud before you call your sponsor with it, you know, just in case. Tweak that wording a little bit, you know. I'd call Betty and I'd tell her everything, and she'd usually say something like, oh, God, you better call your sponsor right now. And that's a really good kind of friend to have. If you're new, I welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous. I am so happy to be here. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.